All right, so right now we are living in an economy that is projected to add, I think it's like $13 trillion of purely automated wealth to the global GDP over the next few years.
Yeah, 13 trillion by 2030, according to McKinsey.
Right, which is just a staggering number. I mean, if you look at the raw capabilities we possess right now, today, June 18, 2026, it's unbelievable.
Absolutely.
We've got algorithms that are, folding proteins to solve deep biological mysteries. We have this hyperconnectivity that makes the whole globe feel like a single room, basically.
Yeah, it's incredible.
It is, by every quantifiable metric, it's the richest, most technologically capable era in human history. But I have a question.
Yeah, let's hear it.
Why are 59% of people currently reporting that their jobs are actively destroying their mental health?
Right.
Like, why, when we have unlimited information sitting in our pockets and software that can literally write our emails for us, do so many of us feel, I don't know, entirely directionless, like spiritually exhausted and just completely hollowed out?
Well, that contrast, I mean, that is the defining paradox of our hypermodern age. We have successfully mapped the physical globe, right? We've mapped the human genome. We are currently mapping the cosmos. But the internal map, the actual architecture of human meaning, has completely collapsed.
Just totally buckled under the weight of it all.
Exactly. It's collapsed under the weight of this technological acceleration. We're essentially watching the external world speed up exponentially while our internal world just fractures.
And that fracture is exactly what we're going to be exploring today. We are doing a deep dive into an incredibly dense, genuinely fascinating stack of sources to look at this modern crisis of purpose.
It's such a crucial topic right now.
It really is. And our anchor text today is this profoundly insightful piece of work called Crafting Purpose in a Meaningless World.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
What makes it so compelling to me is that it refuses to just look at the problem through, one single lens. It pulls together cognitive science, existential psychology, hard economic data on the future of work.
Right, the adult developmental theory stuff too.
Yes, adult developmental theory, and even the metaphysical philosophy from Luigi Nobotega's Fractal Universe.
Is fascinating.
So we're going to look at the macro level economics, the micro level psychology, and really the fundamental question of what it actually means to be a human being in an age where machines can mimic our intellect.
And, as we go through this material, the objective isn't just to admire the problem.
Right. Why not just complaining?
Exactly. The goal isn't to just validate the burnout or wallow in the very real existential dread that so many people are feeling right now. The goal is to understand the precise mechanics of why we feel this way.
The actual underlying causes.
Because once you understand the underlying mechanisms, like how your brain processes meaning, how your adult development can become, arrested, or how you're implicitly conditioned to view your own worth, you can actually begin to construct a new map.
Yeah, a new map for meaning. So if you're listening to this on your commute right now and you're wondering why hitting all your career goals hasn't made you happy, or maybe you're dealing with intense anxiety about the future of your industry, this deep dive is custom tailored for you.
It really is.
But okay, let's unpack this. We have to start by looking at the external environment first.
Right, because you can't just fix an internal crisis without acknowledging the external pressure cooker we're all currently sitting inside.
Exactly. We are trying to navigate this hyper-accelerated, AI-driven economic reality, but we're using internal maps that were drawn for a static industrial world. And the contrast between the macro-level economic story being sold to us and the micro-level human reality is just, it's jarring.
It's an extreme divergence, and honestly, it's the source of immense psychological friction. At the macro level, the optimism is just deafening.
Oh, totally. It's also utopian.
Right. I mean, going back to the source data, those projections from the McKinsey Global Institute, they are predicting that artificial intelligence will add that $13 trillion to the global GDP by 2030.
Which is hard to even fathom.
It is. They're forecasting a 1.2% cumulative GDP growth per year, purely driven by automation, algorithmic efficiency, and AI product innovation.
So if
you only read those macroeconomic headlines, you'd assume we are stepping over the threshold into this like golden age of limitless abundance and leisure.
Right. Like we're all going to be painting pictures and writing poetry while the robots do the work.
Exactly.
But then you zoom into the micro level, you look at the reality of the individual worker on the ground right now, and the picture is completely different because that macro growth is largely predicated on labor substitution.
Right, replacing the human bottleneck.
Yes, scaling efficiency by removing humans. And the human cost is highly quantifiable. Our sources highlight that between 2024 and 2025, we saw nearly 150,000 federal employees leave their positions.
And many of those were involuntary departures due to automated restructuring.
Right. And in that exact same window, over 250,000 technology sector employees were dismissed. Wait, I just want to pause on that for a second.
It's a crazy statistic.
250,000 tech employees in 1 year. In the very sector that is supposedly building this utopian abundance, like, how are the architects of the technology the ones being mass fired?
Well, because efficiency spares no one,
Right.
not even its creators.
Wow.
Once an algorithm can, write code, debug software, and optimize network architecture faster and cheaper than a mid-level engineer, that human engineer just becomes an obsolete expense.
That's brutal.
It is. And this realization has triggered a massive shift in worker sentiment. The sources include this national survey conducted by Jobs for the Future, or JFF.
Right, I saw that.
Just a short time ago, a plurality of workers viewed AI as a net positive force. It was seen as a tool that would augment their capabilities, make their jobs easier.
Yeah, like an advanced calculator.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But this recent JFF survey shows that worker optimism about AI plummeted 10 points in a single year.
10 points. That's a huge drop.
It's massive.
Yeah.
Today, only 39% of workers retain a positive outlook. The vast majority now view it as a net negative for their job security, their wealth-building potential, and just their overall quality of life.
And if you're an early career worker trying to get a foothold in an industry, the data is just terrifying. Entry-level AI-exposed roles have already seen a 13% relative decline.
Yeah, the junior roles are vanishing.
Right. You can't even get in the door to get the experience necessary to move up to the senior roles that the AI can't do yet.
Which brings us to a phenomenon that researchers at the University of Florida have recently conceptualized in a clinical setting.
Oh, this is the AIRRD thing.
Yes, they've identified a condition they call AI replacement dysfunction, or AIRRD. AI replacement dysfunction. I mean, that sounds incredibly dystopian. What does that actually look like in a clinical setting? Like, if someone walks into a therapist's office, it looks like a profound psychological unraveling. As artificial intelligence threatens labor stability across almost every white-collar and analytical sector, employees aren't just feeling like standard workplace stress anymore.
Right. It's not just, oh, I have a big project due.
No, and they aren't just worried about their budgets either. ARD presents with severe systemic symptoms. We're talking chronic insomnia, heightened paranoia regarding workplace monitoring.
Oh, like people thinking the software is tracking their keystrokes to fire them.
Exactly. And a profound loss of identity, along with crippling feelings of worthlessness and resentment. The researchers noted that patients exhibit a type of grief response.
A grief response.
Yeah, but it's a disenfranchised grief because they haven't necessarily lost the job yet. They are mourning the obsolescence of their own utility.
Man, but why paranoia and a profound loss of identity? I mean, losing a job is awful, obviously, because you lose your income and stability. But why does the threat of an algorithm automating a data entry or coding job cause a literal identity crisis?
What's fascinating here is how this exposes a massive underlying societal flaw that we've all internalized.
Okay, what do you mean?
Well, for generations, basically stretching back to the Industrial Revolution and the Protestant work ethic, we have conditioned ourselves to equate human value entirely with economic productivity.
Oh, right.
We have built our entire self-worth around what we can produce, how efficiently we can produce it, and how much the market values that production.
We are our job titles. I mean, when you meet someone at a party, literally the very first question is, what do you do?
Exactly.
And we don't mean, what do you do for joy or what do you do on the weekends? We mean, what is your economic function in society?
Yes. So when a machine can suddenly perform the labor that once defined your entire worth and do it in seconds without needing sleep or health insurance, an existential crisis isn't just likely, it's the logical outcome of our societal conditioning.
Because if your value is your output and your output is now worthless,
What are you?
right.
What are you? That is the root of the 65% increase in workplace burnout right now. That's why 59% of employees are flat out stating their current employment actively damages their mental health.
They are showing up every day to a system that is actively signaling to them that they are completely replaceable.
Precisely.
Okay, but let me push back on this a little bit, because the standard narrative we hear everywhere, like on LinkedIn, from corporate leadership, from government retraining programs, is just upskill.
Oh, the upskill narrative.
Right. The message is always learn to use the AI, become a prompt engineer, adapt to the new tools, and you'll be totally fine.
Well, the upskill narrative is deeply flawed if you are only upskilling in technical procedural domains.
Why, though? Isn't adapting to the new technology the historical precedent? I mean, when the tractor was invented, people didn't just give up. They learned to drive the tractor.
It's a totally different paradigm.
Huh.
A tractor replaces physical muscle. AI replaces cognitive processing. If your response to a machine that can process data instantly is to try and train yourself to process data slightly faster or to learn a new coding language so you can manage the AI, you are playing a losing game.
Because you can never beat it at its own game.
Exactly. The algorithms will always outpace your cognitive processing speed. They will learn the new language before you do. If you try to compete with the machine on its terms, which are efficiency, speed, and data synthesis, you will be crushed.
So it feels like we are being told that the ship we're on is breaking historical speed records, which is fantastic for the shipping company's bottom line. But meanwhile, we are down in the cabin, the hull is breached, water is pouring in, and corporate is just handing us a bucket and telling us to bail water faster.
Right. Upskill your bailing technique.
Yeah, exactly. Upskill your bailing technique.
That is a very accurate assessment of the current corporate strategy. But our sources, specifically referencing the philosophical framework in the companion text, the Oracle 2.0, point out something vital here. Technology isn't the opposite of spirit. It's an extension of human consciousness.
Okay, interesting.
If artificial intelligence is driven by our societal desire for hyper-efficiency, optimization, and control, it naturally erodes human dignity because human beings are simply not built to be perfectly efficient or controlled.
We're messy.
We are. So the only true future-proof skills are the ones that resist algorithmic replication entirely.
The things a machine fundamentally lacks the architecture to do.
Yes. Deep creativity that bridges disparate human experiences. Complex critical thinking that involves ethical nuance, high emotional intelligence, empathy, and the ability to hold space for another person's suffering.
The human element.
The capacities that are rooted in the human soul, not just the human brain.
Mm-hmm.
Algorithmic replication can mimic the syntax of empathy, sure, but it cannot replace the human essence. It cannot actually feel the weight of a difficult decision.
Okay, so if our jobs as mere data processors are threatened, but our innate value as human beings, our capacity for empathy, creativity, connection, isn't threatened, we should theoretically be able to just clock out and find meaning elsewhere, right?
In theory, yes.
Like, if the job is just a job, we should be finding deep purpose in our communities, our hobbies, our families. But we aren't. As we established, burnout is skyrocketing. We are more exhausted on our weekends than ever before. Why is the exhaustion bleeding into everything else?
Because the way we have been trained to work has fundamentally altered the way our brains process reality itself.
Okay, explain that.
The exhaustion isn't just physical fatigue. It is cognitive starvation. To understand this, the text turns to the work of cognitive scientist John Verveke.
Yes, Verveke.
He provides a brilliant, comprehensive framework for this phenomenon, which he calls the meaning crisis.
Hmm.
Verveke argues that the reason we feel so disconnected and empty, despite having access to all the information in human history, is because modern society systematically prioritizes the wrong types of knowledge.
I was reading this section on Verveke, and I'll admit the terminology gets incredibly dense.
It does, yeah.
He breaks human cognition down into what he calls the four ways of knowing. Can you walk me through how he actually categorizes human cognition? Because it seems like this is the root of why our educational and corporate systems are failing us so completely.
It absolutely is the root. Verveke's framework is crucial because it makes the invisible mechanisms of our mind visible. So let's break down the four ways.
All right, let's do it.
The first is propositional knowing. This is knowing that something is true. It is the realm of facts, data, beliefs, and intellectual theories. It's knowing that Paris is the capital of France, or knowing the formula for compound interest, or, you know, knowing the historical dates of the Civil War.
Right. And the digital age gives us unlimited propositional knowing. You can pull a supercomputer out of your pocket and look up any fact instantly.
Exactly.
And our schools test us almost exclusively on this, right? Like, multiple choice tests are basically just audits of our propositional knowing.
Spot on. That's exactly what they are. Now, the second way is procedural knowing. This is knowing how to do something. It encompasses skills, techniques, methodologies, and muscle memory. It's knowing how to ride a bike, how to code in Python, how to execute a marketing campaign, or how to properly format a financial spreadsheet.
And this is where our modern economy places all of its chips. We're heavily rewarded for procedural knowing. We're trained, basically from elementary school through college and into the workforce, to execute tasks efficiently.
We are trained to be human algorithms.
Yeah.
But the crisis begins because our society stops there. We treat propositional and procedural knowing as the entirety of human intelligence. But Verveke introduces a third way, perspectival knowing.
Perspectival knowing.
This is knowing what it's actually like to be in a specific moment from a specific point of view. It is your situational awareness, your state of consciousness, your actual presence in the world.
Give me an example of perspectival knowing in action. Like, how is it different from just knowing how to do something?
Okay, think about driving a car. Oh. Procedural knowing is knowing how to operate the steering wheel, the pedals, the turn signals. But perspectival knowing is your awareness of the flow of traffic around you. It's the spatial relationship between your car and the truck merging into your lane, the glare of the sun on the windshield, and that intuitive sense of when to brake before the car in front of you even hits their lights.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
It requires you to be fully embodied and present in the environment.
And the sheer speed and distraction of modern life just obliterates our perspectival knowing.
It completely destroys it.
We are almost never fully present. We are physically driving the car, but mentally we're ruminating on an email we received an hour ago, or we're anticipating a meeting we have tomorrow. We are completely divorced from our immediate situational awareness.
We live in a state of continuous partial attention. And because our perspectival knowing is degraded, we lose access to the fourth and most critical way of knowing, which Verveke calls participatory knowing.
And this is the big one.
This is the deepest level. It is knowing through being. It is the co-identification of you and your environment. It's the profound sense of belonging, the feeling that you are an integral, connected part of a larger whole.
That sounds almost mystical. What does participatory knowing actually feel like in everyday life?
You've experienced it even if you didn't have the language for it. It's the feeling of collective effervescence when you were at a concert, and for a moment, the boundary between you, the music, and the crowd just dissolves.
Oh, yeah. I know that feeling.
Right. Or it's the deep flow state an athlete enters when they aren't thinking about the mechanics of the game anymore, but are moving in perfect synchronicity with their teammates.
Like they're sharing one mind.
Exactly. Or it's the profound stillness you feel when walking through an ancient forest, where you suddenly perceive yourself not as a tourist looking at trees, but as a biological organism actively participating in an ecosystem. It is the realization that you are not separate from the world. You are deeply embedded in it.
So, if I'm understanding this correctly, modern education and corporate culture wildly over-index on propositional and procedural knowing. Yeah. They treat us as hard drives for storing facts and processors for executing tasks.
Yeah.
But we are fundamentally starved of perspectival and participatory knowing.
We are completely starved. We don't feel like we belong to a living, breathing cosmos anymore. We feel like isolated, alienated observers trapped inside a giant mechanical system.
Wow.
We look at the world through a screen, swiping through propositional data, completely cut off from participatory connection. The key takeaway from Verveke's work is that wisdom, which is the antidote to the meaning crisis, is not accumulating more facts or learning more skills. Wisdom is the harmonious coordination of all four ways of knowing.
Okay, but let me play devil's advocate here for a second.
Go for it.
If I'm a listener trying to survive in a hyper-competitive, incredibly volatile tech economy where layoffs are happening every single day, how does participatory knowing actually help me pay my rent?
That's a fair question.
I mean, I understand that feeling a deep connection to a forest is beautiful, but my landlord doesn't accept collective effervescence as a form of payment. Isn't this kind of deep existential presence a luxury for people who don't have to worry about AI automating their livelihood?
It sounds like a luxury. right up until the lack of it causes your central nervous system to collapse.
Oh, that's, yeah.
Verwege argues that without participatory meaning, you lack the psychological shock absorbers necessary to navigate modern life. You succumb to the anxiety of the modern machine. You burn out.
And that leads to the error.
Exactly. You develop the clinical symptoms of error we discussed earlier, the insomnia, the paranoia, the loss of identity. To survive the modern economy, you don't just need technical skills. You desperately need what Verwege calls an ecology of practices.
An ecology of practices. What does that actually entail?
It means engaging in systematic, disciplined behaviors designed to rebuild your perspectival and participatory knowing. Things like dedicated meditation, Tai Chi, or highly specific relational practices like circling or dialogos.
I've heard of meditation and Tai Chi, obviously, but circling and dialogos are pretty niche. Can you explain the mechanism of how something like circling actually works?
Sure. Circling is a relational practice where a small group of people engage in profoundly honest, present-moment communication.
Okay.
Instead of talking about abstract ideas or past events, which, remember, is propositional knowing, you focus entirely on what is happening in the relational space right now. You share your immediate bodily sensations, your real-time emotional reactions to the other people in the group, and you hold space for their experience without trying to fix or judge it.
That sounds really vulnerable.
It is. It is an intense exercise in rebuilding empathy and perspectival knowing. It forces you out of your isolated intellect and back into a shared participatory reality.
And what about dialogos?
Dialogos is a form of contemplative conversation aimed at shared insight rather than debate. In a typical debate, you are trying to win, right? You're trying to prove your propositional knowledge is superior.
Yeah, standard internet argument.
Exactly. In dialogos, you and your conversational partner are essentially meditating together through speech. You are listening deeply, allowing the conversation to unfold organically, and trying to arrive at a truth that neither of you could have reached independently.
So these aren't just relaxation techniques to help you chill out after a stressful day at the office. They are critical cognitive training.
Yes, training.
They are how you retrain your attention so that you have the internal resilience to handle the external chaos without literally losing your mind.
Precisely. Because if we are starved of true participatory meaning, we don't just sit there quietly in a state of Zen emptiness. Nature abhors a vacuum. And so do the human psyche.
We have to fill it.
When we lack a genuine sense of belonging and purpose, we desperately try to fill the void.
And what do we fill it with? Consumerism, status anxiety, the illusion of success. If we can't feel a deep connection to the cosmos, we settle for buying a luxury car and hoping people look at us at a stoplight, which leads us perfectly into the trap of modern success. And why pursuing it actually arrests our psychological development.
To understand the trap of modern success, the source text turns to self-determination theory, or STT, developed by psychologists Richard Ryan and Edward Dacey.
Right.
STT draws an empirically validated, deeply researched line between two fundamentally different types of human goals, extrinsic goals and intrinsic goals.
Let's define those, because I think we mix them up constantly in our culture. Extrinsic goals are all about external validation, right?
Yes.
Wealth accumulation, physical appearance, social recognition, influence, getting your name in a press release, maximizing your follower count. It's stuff that looks great on Instagram or LinkedIn.
Yeah, extrinsic goals are contingent on the approval or reaction of others. Intrinsic goals, on the other hand, are centered on satisfying inherent psychological needs.
Like what?
These include personal growth, cultivating close, authentic relationships, maintaining physical and mental health, contributing to your community, and pursuing mastery in a craft simply for the joy of the craft itself, not the reward.
And what does the research say about what happens when we prioritize one over the other? Because our entire economic system basically demands that we prioritize extrinsic goals.
The hard truth, which has been backed by extensive longitudinal and cross-cultural research, is that pursuing extrinsic goals actively leads to greater anxiety, depression, and overall ill-being.
Even if you achieve them.
Even when people successfully achieve their extrinsic goals, when they get the promotion, buy the house, get the millions of followers, their wellness actually decreases.
Yeah.
It is a hollow victory.
That is wild.
But pursuing intrinsic goals satisfies our basic psychological needs for autonomy, competence, and relatedness. And that generates profound and sustainable life satisfaction.
It really highlights the difference between success and significance.
Yes, that's a great distinction.
Success is quantifiable. It's the job title, the digits in the bank account, the square footage of the house. But achieving success without internal growth leaves you completely empty. You get to the top of the ladder and realize it's leaning against the wrong wall.
Exactly.
Significance, on the other hand, is qualitative. It's the depth of your influence, your servant leadership, the actual positive impact you have on the people around you.
But the text brings in a really fascinating layer here through the work of Harvard psychologist Robert Keegan. He argues that this obsession with extrinsic success, this whole meaning crisis we are experiencing, isn't just a bad cultural habit. It's actually a form of developmental arrest.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Constructive developmental theory. This part of the source material completely blew my mind.
It's powerful stuff.
Because we tend to think of adult development as just accumulating more facts as we age, right? We get older, we learn more things, we get slightly wiser. But Keegan says that's not how it works at all.
No, it's not about what you know. It's about how you know it. Keegan established that as adults, we have the potential to change the structural way our minds make meaning of the world. The core mechanism of this growth is what he calls the subject-object shift.
The subject-object shift. Can you explain the mechanics of that? How does the brain actually make that shift?
Think of it this way. Whatever you are blindly embedded in, whatever you cannot see, because it is the very lens through which you view the world, is subject. You're subject to it.
Okay.
You cannot question it because you identify with it completely. It's like wearing a pair of red-tinted glasses from birth. You don't know you're wearing glasses. You just think the whole universe is red.
You can't examine the glasses because the glasses are what you are using to do the examining.
Exactly. The shift happens when what was subject becomes object. You take the glasses off and hold them in your hand. You can now look at them objectively rather than just looking through them.
You separate yourself from it.
Right. You detach from the underlying assumption or identity so you can observe it, critique it, and decide whether you actually want to keep it.
So applying this to the meaning crisis, Keegan outlines several stages of adult development, but the text focuses heavily on the transition between three specific stages. Stage three is the socialized mind. And the statistics say roughly 58% of the adult population operates from this stage. What is happening in the socialized mind?
In the socialized mind, your identity, your values, and your definition of success are entirely authored by your surrounding society.
So you're just absorbing it.
Yes. You adopt the beliefs of your family, your peer group, your religious institution, or your corporate culture. You are subject to their expectations. You don't have an independent internal compass. Your compass is calibrated purely by external approval.
Wow.
You chase extrinsic goals because your very container of meaning is defined by whether or not you are meeting the expectations of your social environment.
I love the analogy of thinking about the socialized mind like being a character in a video game, playing by someone else's rules. You are running around the maze, collecting the coins, trying to get the high score based entirely on the metrics the game developers programmed for you.
That's a great way to put it.
You don't question why you are collecting the coins. You just want the game to tell you that you are winning. But what happens when the game crashes? Because that seems to be what is happening right now with the AI disruption.
That is precisely the trigger for the crisis. The socialized mind requires a stable society to function. It relies on the implicit promise that if you follow the rules, if you get the degree, work the long hours, pay your taxes, and be a good citizen, society will reward you with stability, respect, and a pension.
Right, the social contract.
But when those societal promises fail, when you do everything right and still get laid off because an algorithm can do your job for pennies, the socialized mind collapses. The external container breaks. And because the individual has no internal compass, they experience profound vertigo. They plunge into the existential vacuum.
So to survive that collapse, you have to transition to stage four, which Keegan calls the self-authoring mind. The data says about 35% of adults reach this stage. What does the subject-object shift look like here?
In transitioning to the self-authoring mind, the societal expectations that you were previously subject to become object.
Mm-hmm.
You take the red glasses off.
Okay.
You develop an internal authority. You realize that the cultural narrative of success is just one narrative among many, and you actually have the power to write your own. You define your own values, you set your own boundaries, and you pursue intrinsic goals based on your own internal compass, regardless of whether it garners external applause.
So using the video game analogy again, it's the moment you realize you aren't just the character trapped in the maze, you have the capacity to become the programmer.
Example.
You can rewrite the code, you can decide that collecting coins is actually a stupid game and you'd rather build a different game entirely.
And beyond that, there is stage 5, the self-transforming mind. But this is incredibly rare. Only about 1% of adults operate consistently from this stage.
Only 1%. What happens at stage 5?
Well, self-authoring mind, while powerful, can become rigid. You can become trapped in your own self-authored ideology. In stage 5, even your own self-authored identity becomes object.
Whoa.
You realize that your internal framework is just one construction. You develop the ability to embrace paradox, to hold multiple conflicting viewpoints simultaneously without anxiety, and to transcend rigid ideology altogether. You remain in a constant state of fluid evolution.
Okay, so if Keegan says we have to break out of the socialized mind to survive the modern world, why is it so incredibly difficult? Because biologically, evolutionarily, we are hardwired to crave social approval, right?
Absolutely.
The human brain literally registers social rejection as physical pain. So if I consciously want to change my life, find true purpose, and become self-authoring, what stops me?
Keegan identifies a powerful psychological mechanism that prevents this growth, which he calls immunity to change.
Immunity to change? That sounds like a paradox. If I am miserable in my corporate job and I consciously want to leave and do something meaningful, how can I be immune to my own desire?
Because human beings are complex systems of competing commitments. The immunity to change is the phenomenon where incredibly smart, highly motivated people continually self-sabotage.
How so?
You have a visible, conscious commitment to finding purpose. Say, leaving your toxic job to start a nonprofit. But underneath that, you have an invisible, unconscious commitment to safety, predictability, and social approval.
So I might say, I want to start a nonprofit, but my hidden commitment is, I am terrified of looking like a failure to my father-in-law who thinks success means having a corner office.
Yes, and the invisible commitment, because it is tied to the primal fear of social rejection, almost always wins. You will subconsciously orchestrate delays, find excuses, or sabotage your own efforts to ensure you never violate that hidden commitment to approval.
Wow.
You are immune to the change you desire because you are still trapped in the socialized mind's need for external validation.
So how do we break that immunity? How do we actually force the transition from the socialized mind to the self-authoring mind? Because from everything the sources indicate, this shift almost never happens voluntarily while you're just sitting on a beach, sipping a margarita, and feeling relaxed.
Definitely not.
The brain fights the change too hard. What actually provides enough force to break that socialized shell?
It requires a crucible. The transition is almost always triggered by a period of profound suffering or a brutal life event. It requires a shock to the system so severe that the old ways of making meaning completely fail.
Like what kind of shock?
A devastating career disruption, the sudden loss of a loved one, a severe health crisis, or even the overwhelming weight of something like systemic ego anxiety.
Which brings us to the alchemy of suffering. Because suffering can either destroy you or it can forge you. And to understand how to survive that threshold, the text turns to one of the most profound figures in psychology, the psychiatrist Viktor Frankl.
Frankl's work is foundational to existential psychology. His personal story is one of the most profound testaments to the resilience of the human spirit ever recorded.
I mean, his story is unbelievable.
He survived the unimaginable horrors of multiple Nazi concentration camps, including Auschwitz. And out of that ultimate darkness, he wrote the seminal book Man's Search for Meaning and developed a psychological framework called logotherapy.
I remember reading Man's Search for Meaning and being struck by how unflinching it is. Logotherapy isn't about, you know, toxic positive thinking. It's about pure existential survival. What is the foundational premise of his theory?
Logotherapy is based on the premise that the primary motivational force of a human being is not the pursuit of pleasure, as Freud argued, nor the pursuit of power, as Adler argued. The primary drive is the will to meaning.
The will to meaning.
Yes. It is the deeply ingrained desire to find purpose and significance in one's life. In the extreme deprivation of the camps, Frankl observed a stark life-or-death reality. The prisoners who maintained a sense of purpose, those who had a vision for a future task they needed to complete, a cause they still needed to serve, or a deep, transcendent love for a family member to hold on to, demonstrated vastly superior psychological and even physical resilience against trauma, starvation, and torture.
That's incredible.
He frequently quoted the philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche to summarize this observation. Those who have a why to live can bear almost anyhow.
And Frankl outlined three specific actionable ways to find this meaning, even when you are stripped of absolutely everything else. Let's walk through those.
The first is through creative value. This means finding meaning by creating a work, doing a deed, or dedicating yourself to a task that requires your unique contribution.
Okay. The second is through experiential value. This is finding meaning by experiencing something fully like truth, beauty, nature, or by encountering another human being in their very uniqueness, which is basically the essence of deep love.
Right. And the third, and Frankl argued this is perhaps the most profound of the three, is attitudinal value. This is the meaning we find in the attitude we choose to take toward completely unavoidable suffering. When we can no longer change a situation, we are challenged to change ourselves.
So bringing this into our modern context, we aren't facing the literal horrors that Frankl faced in the camps, but we are facing a convergence of global meta-instabilities. We have ecological degradation, runaway climate change, political polarization, and of course the AI rupture we discussed earlier.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, existential psychologists are noting that this pervasive eco-anxiety and structural dread is triggering profound crises of meaninglessness. People just feel paralyzed.
They feel paralyzed because the modern cultural reflex is to avoid suffering at absolutely all costs. We are conditioned to believe that pain is an error in the system.
Yes.
So when faced with this existential dread, we numb ourselves. We retreat into toxic positivity. We sedate ourselves with endless hours of algorithmic digital scrolling, or we turn to chemical escapes.
Mm-hmm.
We try to anesthetize the discomfort.
Exactly.
There is a quote from the companion text, the Oracle 2.0, that hits so hard on this exact point. It says, "Pain is a messenger, not a punishment. It arrives not to torment you, but to speak to reveal imbalance, to uncover what needs tending."
That is a brilliant quote.
So I want to ask you, the listener, directly, what are you doing with your pain right now? The anxiety you feel about your career, the exhaustion you feel at the end of the week, the underlying dread when you read the news. What are you doing with it? Are you numbing it with 4 hours of TikTok before bed? Or are you listening to the messenger? Are you using that pain as the soil to grow actual resilience?
That is the true alchemy of suffering. Existential philosophy teaches that we must shift our definition of happiness entirely. We must prioritize eudaimonic happiness over hedonic happiness.
Let's define those terms clearly for everyone.
Hedonic happiness is the pursuit of momentary pleasure and the avoidance of pain. It's eating a great meal, buying new gadget, or scrolling social media to distract yourself from a bad day. It is fleeting.
Right.
Eudaimonic happiness, however, is the pursuit of purpose, meaning, and self-realization. It often involves enduring significant friction, difficulty, and yes, suffering, in order to achieve a state of deep, lasting fulfillment. When you face your career disruption or your existential dread through the lens of eudaimonic meaning, the wound actually becomes the place where the light enters. You integrate the shadow rather than running from it.
But psychology and sociology, even profound life-altering concepts like Keegan's adult development or Frankl's logotherapy, they ultimately just diagnose the mechanics, right? They tell us how the brain works and they give us tools for resilience. But our anchor text argues that tools alone are insufficient. They don't provide a complete cosmological framework. To truly resolve the existential vacuum, we don't just need a new habit. We need a completely new worldview. We need to understand the architecture of reality itself.
Which brings us to the metaphysical heart of the source material. The fractal worldview, presented in Luigino Bottega's philosophical narrative, Fractal the Trilogy, and expanded upon in the Oracle 2.0.
I am so obsessed with this narrative framework. It operates as this brilliant sci-fi philosophical epic, but it carries the weight of ancient wisdom literature. Let me set the stage for the listener real quick.
Please do.
The story follows a protagonist named Elias Cronus. Elias is watching the world absolutely collapse under the weight of the exact things we've been discussing: ecological devastation, hyper-automation, the total alienation of the human spirit. And in a desperate attempt to understand why existence is so fractured, he builds an incredibly advanced artificial intelligence called the Oracle.
Right.
He feeds it all of humanity's highest wisdom, science, and philosophy to distill an answer. Then, driven by the AI's revelations, he embarks on this perilous physical expedition to Mount Kailash in Tibet, which is revered across multiple traditions as the spiritual axis of the world.
The narrative of Elias's physical journey operates as a profound, multi-layered allegory for the internal human journey. The core metaphysical takeaway that Elias discovers, the truth that the Oracle reveals to him, is that existence itself is structured as a fractal.
A fractal. For those who haven't taken advanced geometry recently, a fractal is a recursive, self-similar geometric pattern. It's a pattern that repeats infinitely across different scales. So if you zoom in on a fern leaf, the tiny offshoots look exactly like the shape of the entire leaf.
Exactly. The micro reflects the macro. And the text applies this not just to geometry, but to consciousness and reality itself. As the oracle states to Elias, the universe does not repeat, it reflects.
And this fractal worldview is structured around what the text calls the Trinity model. Now, the text makes it clear this isn't religious dogma. It's described as the structural, metaphysical blueprint of reality. Let's break down the three parts of this Trinity because it reframes everything we think we know about existence.
The first component of the Trinity is the source, which the text also refers to as spirit. This is the pure, undivided, unmanifested point of origin. It is the absolute stillness behind all motion, the infinite potential before anything takes form.
Okay, and the second component is consciousness, or the light of projection. This is the universal awareness that unfolds out of the source. It is the active force that projects the infinite potential into actual form.
Yes.
The text even introduces a fascinating scientific speculation here, conceptualizing dark matter not just as dead, invisible mass, but as a vast informational field, the actual connective tissue of global consciousness holding the universe together.
And the third component is a space-time membrane, or form. This is the physical reality we inhabit. It is the three-dimensional foundation where the light of projection takes physical shape. It is the grand stage that allows the source to experience itself through the illusion of separation, limitation, and linear time.
So wait, if we apply this fractal model to the crisis we've been discussing, the implications are massive.
They are.
It means that the global macro crises we see, the AI disruption, the greed of the corporate economy, the ecological collapse, are not separate, isolated events. And they certainly aren't separate from your internal individual crisis of purpose. They are fractal reflections of the exact same underlying fracture.
That is the core insight. The external world is a reflection of our internal state. Humanity is currently operating from a level of consciousness that fundamentally seeks to dominate, possess, and control its environment rather than align, surrender, and serve it.
We're trying to force it.
We try to force reality to meet our ego's demands. And the ego's insatiable hunger for permanence and control in a universe defined by impermanence creates the illusion of separation.
Which brings us to one of my absolute favorite concepts in the entire text. It says, the mind is a mirror, not a master. It reflects, but does not originate.
We get so trapped in the ceaseless noise of our own intellect. We think our thoughts are us. We mistake the passing clouds of our anxiety, our ambition, and our fears for the infinite sky of our awareness.
It's like if your ego is trying to control the external world to find meaning, it's like looking into a mirror, seeing that you have dirt on your face, and trying to change your reflection by physically scrubbing the glass.
That's a perfect analogy.
It doesn't work. You just smudge the mirror and get frustrated. The mirror only reflects what is standing in front of it. If you want to change the reflection, you have to change what is being projected. You have to change your state of consciousness.
And this painful realization, the futility of control, is exactly what Elias confronts in the narrative when he descends into the depths of Mount Kailash.
Yes, the shadow scene.
The mountain isn't just rock and ice. It is a profound metaphor for the descent into the deep self, the subconscious. As he goes deeper into the cavern, the space-time membrane thins, and his deepest fears and unexamined ambitions literally manifest before him. He is forced to confront his own shadow.
Let's talk about that confrontation scene, because the dialogue is incredible. The shadow isn't some cartoonish demon. It's the most seductive part of his own ego. The shadow claims, "You need me. Without me, you have no drive, no ambition, no edge. I am the force that built human civilization. I am the reason you survived."
Right.
The shadow represents that deeply ingrained part of all of us that believes we have to conquer time, outwork the AI, and become godlike masters of our universe just to be safe.
It is the ultimate manifestation of the socialized mind and the ego's demand for extrinsic success. But Elias, in this crucible, operates from that stage five self-transforming mind.
He doesn't fight it.
No, he realizes that fighting the shadow, arguing with it, or trying to suppress it only feeds it more energy. He doesn't go to war with his ego. Instead, he responds with profound clarity. Ambition creates momentum, but surrender creates clarity. I no longer seek escape. I seek alignment.
He integrates the shadow through surrender, not through control. He stops scrubbing the mirror.
And in the narrative, when he finally surrenders the need to control reality, the illusion of separation breaks. He falls into a hidden dimension and encounters an angelic interface of pure fractal luminescence.
Wow.
Stripped to his ego, he asks the ultimate agonizing question of human existence. What is my purpose?
And the entity's response fundamentally redefines everything we've talked about today. It tells him, your purpose is not fixed like a command. Purpose is not a destination you are assigned, nor a title you can achieve. Your purpose emerges dynamically as you align with the highest unfolding of awareness in every given moment.
It's beautiful.
Helpful. Ripples through the fractal structure of reality as a harmonization. And finally, when Elias asks who the entity is, the luminescence reveals the ultimate fractal truth. I am you, the future you, the eternal you, the source observing through you and as you.
It's a breathtaking conclusion to that arc.
That is heavy. It's beautiful, but it is heavy. So how do we bring this down to earth? We have journeyed from the stark, terrifying economic data of AI job displacement through the cognitive science of how our brains process reality, past the developmental traps of the ego, into the profound alchemy of suffering, and all the way to the metaphysical heights of Mount Kailash.
It's been quite the journey.
But if I am a listener sitting in my car right now, driving to a corporate job that I am terrified is about to be automated, how do I actually apply the fractal universe to my Tuesday morning?
We bring it down to earth with what the source text provides as the operational manual for this entire philosophy, the purpose compass.
The purpose compass.
It is a 9-step framework designed to navigate this exact transition from the external meaningless grind to an internal self-authored alignment.
Let's dive deep into this compass. I don't just want to list these points off. I want to weave them together because they represent a cohesive journey of transformation. Let's look at the first phase of this compass, which we can call the audit. This involves points 1, 2, and 7 from the framework. It starts with ruthless clarity.
It begins with values clarification. You cannot navigate out of the maze if you don't know what is currently driving you. You have to sit down and do a brutal, honest audit of your motivations.
You have to look in the mirror.
Right. Are you driven primarily by extrinsic goals? Are you exhausted because your entire life is structured around chasing status, appeasing your manager, or trying to outpace your own obsolescence in the face of AI? Or are your actions rooted in intrinsic needs, building authentic community, pursuing genuine mastery, nurturing your health? Purpose cannot grow in the sterile soil of external validation.
And tied directly into that audit is what the compass calls identifying recurring life patterns or examining your fractal self. If reality truly is a fractal where the micro reflects the macro, then your personal life history is a fractal too.
That's a great point.
You have to look back at the timeline of your life. What specific conflicts keep repeating at every job you take? What toxic relationship dynamics keep manifesting, just with different faces? These aren't random unlucky coincidences. They are the curriculum of your soul.
Yeah, the lessons you haven't learned yet.
When you bring conscious awareness to these patterns, you stop being a victim of circumstance and start seeing the underlying structure of your ego.
And once you see those patterns, you have to engage in reducing false obligations. To genuinely move into the self-authoring mind, you have to systematically dismantle the expectations that the socialized mind has built around you.
You have to cut the dead weight.
You have to look at the obligations you carry, the networking events you hate, the prestige you are trying to maintain, the career path your parents approved of, and start saying no. You have to disappoint people. Setting rigorous boundaries clears the psychological and temporal space necessary for your true calling to take root.
I want to pause on that because the friction there is immense. Saying no to false obligations feels like you are letting people down. It triggers that immunity to change we talked about. But if you don't prune the dead branches, the tree can't grow.
Exactly. Which moves us to the second phase of the compass, what we might call the alchemy. This involves points 3, 4, and 6. Once you've cleared the space, you have to deal with the messy reality of your own emotions. This begins with listening to inner unrest.
We love to numb out. As a culture, we are terrified of negative emotion. But the purpose compass insists that you have to treat your difficult emotions as messengers, not masters.
Burnout is not just you being weak or lacking resilience. It is often your body's visceral refusal to participate any longer in a misaligned toxic system.
Wow, yeah.
Anger is not just a loss of control. It is often a profound signal of a violated boundary or injustice that you need to address. Loneliness is not a permanent flaw. It is a call to reconnect with your own interiority. You have to sit in the stillness, feel the physical sensation of the unrest, and ask, what is this trying to tell me?
And when you listen to the pain, you can begin transforming wounds into service. This is the application of Viktor Frankl's logotherapy in real time. You look at the deepest suffering you have endured, perhaps a battle with addiction, a devastating bankruptcy, or the intense grief of losing your identity when your industry collapsed.
Right.
And you ask, how can the specific pain I have navigated become the exact medicine someone else needs right now? The most profound callings often arise when a person decides to dedicate their life to protecting others from the darkness they once had to walk through alone. It alchemizes useless grief into a legacy of healing.
And as you heal, you begin mapping energy and meaning. Purpose is not a static document you write once and put in a drawer. It is dynamic. You need to actively track the energetic resonance of your daily life.
What do you mean by that?
What specific activities, environments, and types of conversations give you a surge of vitality? What depletes you and leaves you feeling hollow? You need to track your flow states. When does the boundary of time dissolve for you? Joy and energy aren't just rewards waiting for you at the end of a long life. They are the real-time compass needles guiding you toward your most authentic participatory engagement with the world.
Which brings us to the final phase of the compass, the alignment. This encompasses points 5, 8, and 9. This is where you lock in the fractal worldview. It requires distinguishing desire from calling.
This is the definitive shift from success to significance. Desire is the ego's insatiable hunger to extract value from the world to fill its own emptiness. I want wealth. I want respect. I want safety.
Right.
Calling is the soul's invitation to contribute value to the world. It is shifting the internal question from what can I acquire from this situation to who am I uniquely positioned to impact in this space.
But you can't maintain that posture of contribution without constant maintenance. You need daily purpose rituals. You can't just listen to a deep dive like this, feel inspired for an hour, and then go back to your hyper-accelerated procedural life. You have to embody the philosophy through that ecology of practices we discussed earlier.
You must build non-negotiable rituals into your day. Meditation, journaling, engaging in dialogues with a trusted partner. You must intentionally create space between your thoughts to step out of the frantic, algorithmic mindset and reconnect with the quiet presence of the observing self, the witness.
And when you cultivate that stillness, you arrive at the final point of the compass, asking the ultimate question. We put so much immense, crushing pressure on our anxious egos to figure it out, to find our purpose as if it's a lost set of keys.
Yeah, we try to force an answer.
The compass asks us to do what Elias did on the mountain, surrender. You have to shift from demanding, what do I want from life, to becoming a receptive, quiet portal and asking, what is life trying to express through me?
When you adopt that posture of receptive alignment, the crisis of meaning begins to dissolve. You realize you are not an isolated data processor separate from the universe. You understand that the terrifying technological accelerations and the existential voids we are facing as a species are just the agonizing labor pains of a new level of consciousness trying to emerge.
That is a powerful way to frame it.
This compass shifts us from the passive, socialized posture of waiting for a savior or a perfect AI to fix the world for us to becoming what the text beautifully calls gardeners of a new renaissance.
Gardeners of a new renaissance. What an absolutely incredible, expansive journey we've taken today. We started in the cold macroeconomic anxieties of artificial intelligence and the devastation of the modern workplace. We moved through the cognitive traps of how our educational systems fail us, the developmental necessity of breaking out of the socialized mind, and the profound demanding alchemy of using our deepest suffering to forge true meaning.
And we ended with the breathtaking realization of the fractal universe.
The understanding that the consciousness of the entire cosmos is projecting through you exactly where you are right now.
It represents a fundamental systemic shift in what it means to be human.
Mm.
Moving away from a paradigm of seeking dominion and control over the world to seeking a profound participatory alignment with it.
I want to talk directly to you, the listener, for just a moment before we go. If you are feeling exhausted today, if the speed of the modern age feels terrifying and the demands of your life feel completely overwhelming, your feelings are entirely valid. You are responding rationally to an irrational system.
Absolutely.
But I want you to know that this era of disruption is also an incredible threshold for your own awakening. You are not broken. You are simply standing at the base of your own mountain. The old maps have burned, but you have the capacity to draw a new one.
And as we close, I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over, building on the profound reality of the fractal worldview. We've established the premise that the universe is a fractal that reflects rather than repeats, and that your mind is the mirror. So consider the implications of that physics. What happens to the actual fabric of reality if you intentionally change the quality of your attention in the very next seemingly mundane conversation you have today?
Oh, wow.
If every single life is a portal for the source, could the act of simply bringing deep, unbroken, participatory knowing to the next 5 minutes of your day literally alter the space-time membrane of your personal reality? The bell of awakening hasn't just tolled for humanity in some abstract historical sense. It is ringing for you right now in this exact moment.
The map is in your hands, but the territory is yours to walk. The external metrics of modern life might be completely broken, the economic landscape might be chaotic, but your internal compass, if you're willing to clear the noise and listen to it, is entirely intact. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep exploring these sources, keep questioning your inherited maps, and whatever you do, keep listening to that inner unrest. We'll see you next time.